Coming up shortly, Arnab continues to answer all the questions that came in last week in episode 87 of Attention Plus with Arnab Ray. This episode was recorded on the 31st of May in this god-awful year of 2020. I am Vikram Mohan, and this week on other podcasts from Foursquare, that's right, all the podcasts from Talking Stuff are now brought to you under the brand new name Foursquare. So visit foursquare.net for details. That's the number 4SPIRE.net, and you'll get all our podcasts right there. And now our host, who's been in blistering form of late with his posts about Vakar Yunus and Yogendra Yadav. Did I miss out anything, Arnab, or was that it?
No, that's it. As I said, I've been writing this stuff for the last 15 years, but sometimes people like them and sometimes people don't. It's just that my style of comedy has never been, and I realize that increasingly there's no right or wrong. As I written in a I've written in a Facebook post that ultimately there is no good art, good comedy, bad comedy. It's all, you know, an artist trying to find his or her audience.
Right.
So I've kind of seen that the most of the audience is for, you know, the Kunal Kamra kind of humor, that is what is popular nowadays. You know, is essentially you take a picture of Arnab Goswami, put it on a dog and say Dalla, and that is it. And for me at least, it's not funny. It's not intellect. I mean, there's no art in that. There is no art in, you know, it's perfectly fine to hate on someone. It's perfectly fine to use words, and words are a very powerful medium. Pictures are powerful too. I'm not saying that there is anything wrong with the pictorial representation. Cartoons are, but cartoons aren't necessarily, those are the pictorial equivalents of Tere Baap Kutta Hai. And you know, that's the level of humor that people nowadays consider humor. And again, this is something which I don't. And this goes for people on both sides too. You know, when there was this slew of cartoons, you know, showing Manmohan Singh is Singham, or, you know, morphing a picture of, you know, him on a woman's body to show he's a, you know, kind of submissive. You know, that kind of, you know, there are many good reasons to not like Manmohan Singh, but to fall on these kinds of tired tropes. And much of what passes for stand-up comedy is just gali-galoj, and they're not funny, at least for me in my age group. And I like to think of myself as contemporary and still with it. I like to hear what young people are, you know, thinking, saying. I don't want to consider myself old. You know, I'm if this sounds a little bit like Devanand, maybe I am morphing into him. But it's just that I can't get that kind of, it's either there is either these tired regional stereotypes, and I'm perfectly fine with comedy having regional stereotypes, or, you know, pushing the envelope. Making fun of religion is absolutely fine for me, but people selectively choose certain religions and they don't choose other religions, because then there are two reasons why. You know, honestly, they will say that this whole punching up, punching down, that certain religions you can make fun of because that's punching up, certain religions you cannot make fun of because they're punching down. But the real thing is fear. That is really what they're afraid of. And unfortunately, what happens with this is that now, you know, this the level field is equalized. Now everybody wants to use fear to stop you from making fun of their religion. So that then becomes the common currency. It needn't have been. There could have been a time when people could have said, no, there is no punching up, punching down. You are allowed to make fun of all religions. You cannot then be shamed and be shut down and deplatformed because you are a phobe. But people didn't do that. People deplatformed those people because of that thing. And now basically all religions, even the religions that were once tolerant and acceptant of people making fun of them, have decided, well, why should we? So that's why this has overall led to a decline in, you know, comedy. And then you have this cult of competitive intolerance. And I don't know how I started talking about this, but I have. Well, by the way, I had a question. So what about talkingstuff.net? Is that talkingstuff.net brand? Is that gone? Is this been
absolutely
replaced
by
Foursquare? Or?
No, absolutely. So Talking Stuff continues to be a YouTube channel. So you can head over to youtube.com/talkingstuffnet also and get DIY videos and home automation and, you know, makers and creator videos for them. So all the podcasts are under Foursquare.net, and the videos continue to be under Talking Stuff due to some semi-technical reasons.
Yes. So Talking Stuff, you normally would think would be the podcast part. Right?
Wouldn't
the
you?
Video
part. Exactly.
Okay, watching stuff though. Yes. Watching stuff does seem
that
to
gets you into a different zone.
It gets you in a different zone, and you'd soon find Walker Yoon is there, or the person who hacked his account in the watchingstuff.net part. Okay.
I wanted to ask you about the grim goings on in the US right now, but you've set the tone with Vakar, somehow I don't want to drag it back into that. But
when I came to the US, again, it was not that US is a particularly tranquil place. There have been things like the Rodney King riots in LA in 1992. But as if COVID wasn't enough, the US is, I don't know if you guys have been following the story, but just so that you have some context. So there were two stories that happened about a few days ago. One story is the one that got the most maximum amount of airplay because it's shocking, because it's essentially a live video of a man being murdered by the police. And there are two kinds of, police brutality that often, comes to the fore in the US. One is the police, and it's 100% of the time it's a white police officer on a black alleged perpetrator. That's obvious. That there's never the other way around, or virtually never. So what usually happens is that there are usually shots fired. So usually the cop fires a shot and kills someone who was either unarmed or was innocent or wasn't doing anything. And sometimes these are caught on video, sometimes they're not caught on video, but every time the cops, the police's logic is that they felt threatened by that person, that they felt that person could be carrying a gun. And again, in the US, since you're allowed to carry a gun, there is some water in that, and that their instinctive, that the instinct to protect themselves made them shoot first. And this is also the reason why many times the policemen have gotten away, because whether they accept it or not, the line for convicting a policeman of shooting somebody dead is much higher. If they can prove in court to an extent of even a doubt that he fired, it was a wrong judgment call, but it wasn't driven by hatred, or it wasn't driven by anything else. It was just a wrong judgment call. And maybe that person might have, if the person had resisted arrest a little bit or said something a little bit aggressive, then they could spin it as, we immediately thought the guy had a gun. This was absolutely nothing like that. I mean, this person, he was accused of passing a $20 counterfeit bill. Can you imagine that? No, that's it. For the crime, which obviously he most probably didn't even know that he had passed a $20 counterfeit bill. They took that person, they dropped him on the sidewalk, and as he kept on saying, I'm dying, I can't breathe, he's calling out for his mother. This white cop just sat on his neck using his full body weight and basically choked him to death. And there was absolutely, and because the entire video is captured, and people are standing there, they're shouting, they're abusing the cops. They're saying, that man is dying, get your foot off. And he doesn't do anything. He just looks at the crowd. And there's another policeman who's not white, actually, who's a Pacific Islander, I think, if I'm not wrong, who just stands there and just looks at the crowd. He doesn't do anything either. So it's not just I believe that person should get life for murder, and that other cop should get whatever the other thing is for abetting murder.
Right.
He's definitely abetting murder, and this person is a murderer. There's no... I mean, I don't know what the U.S. judicial system is. It possibly will get away also. But the fact is, this was plain and simple murder. And there was absolutely no threat perception anywhere. This person was on the ground. And this person, all he had to do was move his foot away from his neck. And I have, unlike, and this is perhaps a culture shock for many Indians, but U.S. police are extremely aggressive towards non-white. I have seen it, experienced it myself. If you're not a white person, even if you're Indian, if you're African-American, they openly, blatantly will talk to you in a different way, because US police people are in general racist. There is no, I mean, even cops, once they leave the force, they don't deny it. And this is, and do you know how they can get away with it? They can get away with it because they have a police union. Haha, CPM. They have a police union that allows them, and these unions are the hotbeds of racism, as to say. So they protect the corrupt cops, the racist cops, and that's how these guys get away. I would be curious to see if this person gets away with murder. I hope not. But also, what happens after that is that people take advantage of this to loot stores. And this is, again, something which happens in India also. So the only thing that doesn't happen in the US, and these things are very familiar to us in India. The only thing is that, you know, people looting and then people justifying the looting and saying, you know, that somehow a murder, which is a racist, racially motivated murder. So there was another second story, which again got quite a lot of airplay in the US, but might not have gotten that much attention outside, because there was nothing bad happened to it. But what happened was that in Central Park, there was a white lady who was a liberal, actually, because she kind of contributed to Obama. So she was walking her dog off leash. And this bird watcher, who was an African-American man, said, you should not be walking your dog off leash, because he's a bird watcher, right? Because dogs will go and, you know, eat the birds. And this lady keeps threatening him on the phone that I'm going to call the cops and say that there's an African-American man threatening me. She keeps on saying African-American man threatening me. And it's so obvious that what she's suggesting is they'll come and they'll shoot you. Okay. So she is deliberately using that adjective when that adjective has nothing to do with anything that person has said with respect to keeping the dog on or off collar. So this is, and this is again something, a point that many people have made, that this lady is a liberal. Okay. But when she comes to a conflict, and that's the even the saddest part, is this person actually is threatening that man implicitly, that he also recognizes the fact that if the cops come and it's a white lady versus a black man, it's the white lady who will get believed. And she is weaponizing that prejudice straight up. And it's the same day in another corner of the world, in a corner of the country, that this other man, he is essentially murdered by the cops.
And she's aware that she's getting filmed, and she still doesn't.
She's aware that she's too mad at that point of time to realize what is going to happen. So obviously this is not, you know, she's also, if you see the video, she's also choking the dog, actually.
Right. Yeah. She was just the leash.
Yeah. Which is why the rescue actually took the dog away from her immediately. So she's obviously not a person who should not have a dog, essentially, and should also, in this case, not have a job also. So again, the point again isn't the lady per se, but this is a very, very persistent prejudice against non-white people, that white people, and the sad thing is the white person will not accept this in polite company. But the fact that this prejudice exists is not only the problem that it exists, but the problem that a section of people will use that in order to get their way. And this is as shocking as a murder. Of course, the ramifications of that are not that, since nobody's dead. But you see why that happens. You have to kind of parse that to understand what was going on. That I can guarantee that in any corner of the US, a white man who's accused of trying to pass a counterfeit $20 bill, he would not be dead. There is nothing that he could have done that would have led him to die. There was a video once that they showed of this white guy who was high on meth, and he had a knife and he was brandishing it at three white cops who were coming to arrest him. None of them reached for their guns. They were trying to kind of move around, tackle him down to the ground, take his knife away. None of them brought their guns out and shot the man. If it was a black guy, they would have shot him dead. He had a knife out, by the way. And so many black people have been killed for not having any weapon. Forget showing it. Not having any weapon at all. actually saying, "Sir, I'm not armed. I don't have anything." Even that didn't save them. So this just brings to forth the only difference between the US and India. And again, this is why I keep on saying that the politics of both are not comparable, is that while everybody understands that it is a problem of racism, which it is, there is no attempt to say that the president ought to resign for this. In India, it is Modi ji must resign. People realize that there is systemic racism. Now, if there's something that Trump says, if there's something that Trump does, then people will say it. But the act itself is not taken to be a reflection of the even of performance of such a hated president as Trump is. So the level of maturity of the opposition is in a different zone. Besides, of course, the fact, of course, that's understandable that you don't have U.S. Media figures rushing to Indian newspapers trying to get their bylines in with their like simplistic generalizations and they don't do that. But that's of course the difference between India and US. But it's been very distressing. I mean, we have right now, I'm in LA and there is a curfew outside. Like after 8 o'clock, I just got this huge beep on my phone, which usually is used for something called an Amber Alert if there's a child missing, which said that at 7:30, that said that 8 o'clock, nobody leaves the house because there's a curfew now from 8 o'clock night to 5 in the morning. And, you know, on top of COVID,
was this 15... for COVID?
No, this is not for COVID. This is for riots. 10, 15 miles down, there is like mayhem on the streets from where I live. And this is LA. This is not Minnesota where this thing happened.
Exactly.
Yesterday there were people tried to march onto, you know, White House. And of course they couldn't even get close. So there are like citywide this protest. Somebody said that Chicago there is also a curfew. So again, the point is that it's a tough time and it's a very difficult watch to see what the cops do, what one person does. And again, it's not a question of one rogue cop, you know. It is fairly, and that's been fairly well documented, that racism is systemic, and I've seen it myself. I don't need to read a paper or listen to anyone. I've interacted with US cops, and of course there are some very nice policemen who are very polite, but there are a lot of people who are, the thing is that there are good cops and there are bad cops, but you'll rarely find any even bad cop being anything but supremely polite to white people.
That actually makes it a very easy segue into the first question. Then this comes in from Sagar, who wants to ask you if you ever regret moving to the US and not some other country.
I do regret moving. It's a very good question. Again, the proverb is always that the grass is greener on the other side. And that is, and again, since I have not lived in any other country other than the US, my knowledge of that other country is purely based on not a lived experience. So other than India, which again, I have a fairly good idea of, I would have perhaps, there were some times when I wondered if I would have been happier moving to Europe because in Europe, the stress is much less in terms of work stress. There is much more, for taxes are high, of course. But I genuinely believe that life in Europe, again, it depends on how rich you are. If you are in Europe, you are not allowed to get very rich. But since I know that I will not be getting very rich either, I think that for people in my earning zone, life in Europe, it's not that the savings, of course, and everything in terms of absolute magnitude, much. I mean, you get to keep a lot more in the US, no matter how much we could grudge the tax system here. But I would say that in Europe, in certain countries in Europe, Germany, for instance, or which is actually a fairly well-functional country and pretty much everything works well, I would have liked to stay in a place with much more public transportation, for instance, because I'm scared to drive. That's why. So a place when in the US, if you're scared to drive, you're effed really. So because there is virtually no public transportation. So I would have liked to stay in a place with public transportation, with more holidays, with more time that I could get from my job to write books. In the US, it's changing a little bit. US is being becoming more like Europe. For instance, I'll give you an example now. Most companies have as a benefit paternity leave. So you do get paid paternity leave in most major companies now as a benefit. When my daughter was born, I got 2 days. That's it. And that was basically a state mandated thing that you get it only from the state. It's no company provides it. At that point of time, companies, I don't know if Microsoft and Google and all those companies which were flush with cash did. But nowadays, this is a fairly standard and some states are actually mandating it. Now, so there is a move, at least in the US with the Bernie revolution, to kind of move to a lightweight version of Europe. At least it's much more European in that sense than it was, I would say, even 10 years ago. But coming back to the question, maybe I would have been a happier individual staying in an European country.
So speaking of, I mean, moving, that brings me to Lisa's question, who asks whether you enjoy traveling and whether you have any memorable travel story that you want to share. Do you like traveling?
I don't like traveling. I don't like traveling at all. There's a reason why I don't like traveling. Maybe that's the reason why I don't like traveling is because for me, happiness is being relaxed. Ultimately, at the very core of what I personally believe is my personal definition of happiness is, am I relaxed? And when I'm traveling, I can never be relaxed. As a matter of fact, I am most stressed out when I'm traveling. Because of just the way we travel. It's not that maybe if I was a super rich guy who was traveling in first class and having a chauffeur pick me up and, you know, go and stay in a 5-star hotel, maybe I wouldn't feel stressed. Maybe that would be, and I've often told my wife that, you know, if we go on a vacation, I want to spend a lot on a good hotel. And my wife says, you know, why should we just go there to sleep? We should spend more on, like, and that's exactly the problem with me. Even if I go somewhere, for me, I don't like to, like, wake up early in the morning, like 5 o'clock, take a car, go, you know, drive to a place with three hours away, and then see something at 8, then go from there to there, like, the, you know, planning from here to here to here, have lunch on the way, then go. That to me is extremely, extremely stressful, especially in a place where you don't know the culture, where you don't know the roads, where many times you might not even know the language. So I just cannot find myself relaxed. It was one thing when I was alone. At least it was not that I particularly enjoyed doing it, but I had to travel because I used to go to different conferences. And so once we were there, of course, you know, if you're in Switzerland and you don't travel the country, then, you know, the joke's on you. But, you know, I've done that. I've traveled around Europe when I was a student. But at least I was a student. I stayed in youth hostels and, you know, did all that stuff. So it's not that I'm speaking from, like, I haven't done it. I have done it. But it's not something which I particularly look forward to doing. It's not something which I enjoy. With respect to travel stories, again, since I haven't gone to a lot of places in the world, I don't particularly have a lot of travel stories, except, again, most of my travel stories are from my teenage years. Traveling with my parents. I remember there was a time in which we were coming back from Goa in a train and some criminal crook got in our train to possibly steal something. And he sat down and, you know, my mother chased him away. I think that was a particularly thrilling story. Maybe me recounting it now doesn't make it sound as thrilling as it was. but most of my travel stories are, there was a time when we went to Simla and this is not a travel story, but the market caught fire and I saw Monisha Koirala in Manali bargaining for shoes. Again, I don't think these are
that's a good travel story.
So I don't know if these are particularly great travel stories, but no, but coming to the point, I don't enjoy traveling at all. I'm a very, and this is a persistent source of friction in our marriage. My wife does want to travel. And I just don't want to move. For me, being at home, watching a movie, reading a book, that is to be relaxing. Even actually going to work, I would rather prefer going to work rather than going on vacation, because it's just that it's much less stressful. At least I know where I'm going and I know when I'll come back.
Okay, we've got a couple of questions. I'm going to club them. And these are, as you would expect, about a couple of episodes back when we had Abhinandan over here. So I'm going to club these two questions. One is, of course, from Vyomnath. Who felt that it was very aggressive. Of course, people only listen to the podcast which we recorded. You did have banter with him before and after recording. So I don't know the behind the scenes as well. So he was asking whether you felt it was very aggressive. And similarly, we have Adarsh, who wants to know whether you think you will be invited to the News Laundry podcast again. I guess that's a question better left to Abhinandan. But any thoughts?
So again, what's the question?
The first one is whether you thought that it was very aggressive. And second one is whether you will be invited to News Laundry podcast.
So first of all, I can't answer for News Laundry, right? So honestly, you need to ask him. You need to ask Abhinandan, and you need to ask News Laundry whether I would be invited to News Laundry or not. Heated, yeah, sure. I mean, again, if the point is, I mean, debates are heated. I just hope that Abhinandan didn't take, and he said it, he didn't take it personally.
Yes, absolutely. In the sense,
so again, as long as things aren't personal, I think heated is okay, as long as there's something substantial going on. Unlike what happens in an Arnab Goswami,
you were not pointing spears at each other.
Where you take a toy aeroplane and point it at the ghuser denge. Unless you've gone to that level, which is there's a lot of heat, but there is no light. As long as there is some light which is being produced as a concomitant of the heat, I think it's okay. I have no problems in heated debates. I have no problems. I hope Abhinandan also doesn't have problems. I don't hope that anybody who I will invite on this program. First of all, there are two things. First of all, I don't think that conflict is essential. I'm not going to bring people just so that to have conflict with them. I know that conflict sells. People will say, well, that's what people like to tune into. That's why reality shows work. Reality shows, the best reality shows are ones that have a lot of conflict in them. I don't want this podcast to become a reality show. So I do not want to compete on the kya diya, kya, kaise debate kya, khamosh kar diya and all that. This is not the reason why I have guests on this show. And even if I have somebody who I don't agree with, the purpose of bringing them to my show is not to have a showdown or to basically have a bit of heat and a bit of aggressiveness. That is, if that happens, it happens. But that is not the point. The point is for me to understand what that person is saying and where he or she is coming from, and for me to be able to get my point across. Now, as long as words are civil, I mean, voices being raised, you know, sometimes it happens because of the excitement, but it's nothing more than that. So again, there's a line. I think we all know what that line is. I think we all know that Arnab Goswami very intentionally crosses that line. And the thing with him is that just like, being a drug addict, your doses have to keep on increasing in order to give you that same level of high. Nowadays, Arnab Goswami, what started out as never, 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 ever, has now degenerated to this, what we saw. And very soon we will reach, we'll actually have fist fights and people throwing chairs and stuff. this is where it is obviously going to land up, because now that we have this Pakistani guy who it's so obvious that guy was told to do this. I mean, what is the chances that both have identical props on both in two different countries? They just happen to be sitting with those same things. So this obviously there's nothing spontaneous about that at all. In case you didn't understand, this guy has been paid to do that in Pakistan. And obviously,
how do you satirize that one? I mean, you just can't.
You can't. It's now a self-parody of itself. So that obviously I don't want to do. But other than that, I'm perfectly fine with conflict.
Also, because people wouldn't know what you're pointing at since it's an audio podcast.
Exactly.
Speaking of that, I mean, I'm not sure I get this question entirely. I'm going to read it out as it is. Baba Jatidari asks, how do you compare NDTV with Fox News in the US?
How do I compare NDTV
these two? I don't know. I don't. Apples and oranges, probably. Anyway.
So, you know, comparison wise, again, Fox News and NDTV, see, it's not a question of just Fox News. I mean, most channels in the commercial media space in both countries of India and US have to cater to echo chambers. This is, again, something which I've discussed ad nauseum on this show. And the example that I use is of CNN. I think we brought this up in the episode with Abhinandan, that a few years ago, CNN was being hammered in the ratings war by MSNBC. Because CNN was seen to be boring. Even though the Republicans called it Communist News Network, the thing was that CNN tried to hold itself true to some of the old world journalistic principles. They tried to be, whether they were neutral or not is another thing. You know, opinions differ. But the fact is, at least when they came on screen, they were trying to be impassive. They were trying to present facts. They were not trying to put opinions. That's gone out the window with CNN as they have lost the rating wars. Now you see one Cuomo brother interviewing the other Cuomo brother purely for virality. Okay, purely it's like good-natured brothers bantering, which is perfectly fine, except that there is a COVID crisis going on. You have many of CNN anchors now basically looking into the camera and saying, "Shame on you, Trump! You know, shame on you and your support." Like, so they. And this is shown in their, this has had an effect on their numbers. Their numbers have gone up and they are now viable competitors to MSNBC. So I think when you're asking me to compare NDTV to Fox, I think the real question over here is commercial television media. In a way, Fox started this. Fox was the first television channel which was started with the Express. So other channels in the US, they didn't start with, let's have a liberals channel. It was just that they only hired liberals, and hence it became a liberal channel. So the liberalism, the liberal slant came later. It was a byproduct of the people they chose to hire. Liberal people hired other liberal people who hired other liberal people. With Fox, it was different. From day one, it was started by a conservative. For the reason, let's start a conservative channel. That was the reason it started. Because it's one of the things about any, you know, in any organization, any media organization, if you don't have that, if you don't have a strong bias, which is imposed from above that we need to have conservatives, what will happen is all channels will ultimately trend towards the left. And because the talent pool comes from that. The media, the people who study media, the journalism majors, they all are like that. So if you let them hire the people they want to, any quote-unquote right-wing news outlet will gradually gravitate towards the left. That's why unless the commercial aspect of it, unless the business dictates that, no, you will not, you can hire whoever you want, but they will have to say this. Unless that happens, you cannot have a right quote-unquote channel. You cannot have a channel like Times Now or a channel like Republic TV until and unless there's a guy who shouts every day, we need to support Modi. We need to support Modi. If you don't support Modi, you've lost your job. Unless you get that memo every day, every channel will, you know, in a converging series ultimately become NDTV. And NDTV, again, I don't think Pranoy Rai started with, let's start a channel for Congressies. Again, in those days, there was virtually no BJP. If you look at NDTV, their founding fathers and mothers,
I mean, Sagarika Ghose, her father was like, you know, again, in those days, he was kind of against some of the excessive Congressy censorship that used to happen, Bhaskar Ghose, but he was still very much a Rajiv Gandhi man. And if you, that's why Sagarika Ghose writes Indira Gandhi fan fiction and passes them off as biographies. So this is a family that basically depends on who, whatever they are, or whoever they are, on the Gandhi family. So of course, Namak Khaya Hai Sardar at that point of time. And that's really been who in the core founding group of NDTV. Now, of course, Arnab Goswami, again, you know, he felt left out. He felt that he was not given his, you know, his proper worth, that he was kind of sidelined by the Sardesai. So, of course, he's revolted and he's gone over to the dark side and become a Sith Lord. But the Jedi, you know, they didn't really start out by saying let's be a group of Congress cheerleaders. It's just that they have morphed into that. They have morphed, and now it makes business sense also, because there's obviously going to be in a way it's necessary also. It should not be that every channel should become like what Republic TV and Times Now are. I mean it's a very dangerous media landscape where everybody has to be like that. But so there needs to be a countervailing force like NDTV, and there needs to be the Scrolls of the world, and there needs to be the Op India. So as long as there is a fairly diverse group, then it's okay. But again, I personally cannot engage with any media organization which has a political bias ingrained into its DNA. I think it's perfectly fine to shift from one point of view to another. But NDTV is as doctrinaire as I would say at Times Now. They just do it a little bit more subtly. I mean, my critique of the right-wing media in India is always that it's okay to be biased, but at least sound journalistic. The problem with Arnab Goswami is at one point of time, whatever his biases might have been, at least he sounded like a journalist. NDTV, to their credit, still do kind of sound like a journalist. I mean, they're still putting across their biased viewpoints. They're still suppressing some news. They're putting spin. They're doing the exact same thing, but Arnab Goswami is doing. But at least they don't have two people on two sides of the camera pointing like toy models of planes and saying "Guser denge, guser denge, guser denge." At that point of time, can you take anything that channel does with any form of seriousness, unless you are yourself a part of that ecosystem? So in any case, you have surrendered your brain, in which case you are already part of the converted. Is there any human being who otherwise would have said, no, actually, you know what, maybe I want to keep an open mind? The moment an open-minded person comes and sees two people pointing toy planes at each other like that, no matter what they're saying, no matter what comes out of the channel from that point, it's tarnished. It's tarnished for good because of that image. In a way, Times Now and Republic don't give a F. But I think that if you really want to, from a holistic point of view, why don't they give an F? Because they are not there to provide a platform for all forms of political, for all kinds of politics. They're not here to do good things. They're just there to make money. But for us, who are not in the business of making money from media, it's very important that right-wing media also at least has the veneer of journalism, that they don't reduce themselves to being, you know, Big Boss, or even worse than Big Boss, I would say. I mean, if there's anything trashier than Big Boss now on TV, it is an hour with Arnab Goswami. There is no doubt about that.
Rakhi Ka Swayamvar.
Yes, but Rakhi Ka Swayamvar was very, very, very innovative and original.
I loved it.
It has not been replicated since. So again, this...
Which actually, you're making it very easy to transition to questions. So since you were talking about journalistic slants, Ad Smiles asks whether you have any recommendations on people to follow, I assume on Twitter, for balanced and centrist opinions.
For people to follow. Well, look at my follow list. I think my follow list is particularly good. I like people who I follow, and there are people who I don't like. I unfollow, but you know, people like right. people, you know, just look at my follow list. If you're genuinely trying to look for people who to follow, and just see if there are people there who you don't follow.
So. I think the way I approach it honestly is that since everyone would have a slant, I kind of make it a point to have equal number of left and right, or whatever you choose to call it. That way, I see the slant from both ends, and it's up to me to.
Yeah. Some people I follow purely for the entertainment. It's not that, but like Ashutosh, for instance, I follow because of
you're a fan.
Because I'm a fan. I don't really care what he says. I really don't care. But you know, I'm a huge fan of him. So
let's talk about the TV and media for a bit. There are a few questions there. So this is something. Of course, we've got a few questions in this area, and they are kind of on the same theme. So the first one is from N. Mankale, who's asking, is it not possible to watch just a movie or series without analyzing the politics behind it, like we used to in the olden days of Govind Nihalani or Shyam Benegal? Wasn't there politics in those days too? There was, wasn't it?
There was politics, but the politics wasn't directed at, it was against the system. It was more like... It was more apolitical than politics. I mean, yes, there were, you know, let's take as an example. Let's, you know, forget. Have any of you seen Snowpiercer?
Yeah, I have.
So
it's a series now too, by the way.
Excuse me?
It's coming up as a series on Netflix.
Yeah, I saw it. Got credible reviews. The series saying that.
I've seen only the movie though.
You should go and see the movie.
No, because I've seen the movie. I've not seen the series. I've seen only.
Yeah. So, the thing about that movie is it's an extremely political movie. Again, even Parasite is an extremely political movie. So there's no problem with a political movie. I don't have any problem with a political movie. I mean, you cannot see Snowpiercer and say there's no. It's not politics. Obviously, the entire thing is an allegory. The train is an allegory. What Ed Harris says at the end, you know, essentially saying, you know, that this is the way the world is. The world subsists on slavery. The world subsists on people killing each other. If there are too many people, there's just not enough resources in the world. So people have to die in order for you to live. Then some people need to be slaves in order for you to live your life. And if you can't accept the fact, then
the animal comes good, essentially.
Then I'm not the problem. You are. That's really what he tells the person at the end. And then there is this other person who blows up the train who says, no, there is another way. It doesn't have to be this. The other way might be terrible and it might be very, very risky. But it's not as if this is the world that we are in. There is something else outside. And as he says, you know, the snow is melting and stuff. So, and at the end, last night, you see a polar bear appear. So, you know, life is coming back to the earth. So that there is... You know, it's a tough world, but it doesn't have to be that the life you lead has to be a zero-sum game based on somebody else losing something. Again, this is an extremely political statement, but it isn't saying that, you know, it isn't making a comment about a particular religion. It is not making a comment about a particular political figure. It is not making a comment about a particular political party. The web series which have been commissioned by Netflix have become. See, it's perfectly fine to make political movies. I honestly, they, you know, it's, I mean, that's been a genre that's been there for ages. But there's a difference between a political movie and a propaganda movie. And currently, what many of the things that Netflix greenlights almost exclusively are propaganda movies. Now, as to why they do it, you know, honestly, I don't know. I mean, I think I do, but it's just the way that the people who take the decisions are politically inclined in that respect. I mean, they agree with the political propaganda. That's the reason. And they also believe that the people who watch Netflix also will align with that political ideology. So there's both a commercial part. There's both a commercial part of that decision. And there's also the, hey, I really like this stuff. This is exactly how I believe the world is. So that is the politics that I end up discussing more. I mean, I'm perfectly fine with movies being political. I mean, Parasite is very political.
Actually, where you're going with right now kind of answers the second question. That's from Radhakrishnan Ravi Iyer. And he asks, how do we deal with this paradox where the making and acting is great but the content has clear elements of propaganda or Hindu phobia, or I would say even probably Islamophobia. Like you said, everything is very, political, like you said. So you were kind of addressing this issue.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead. I didn't mean to break your chair. No, it was just that you were answering this question, so I interjected.
Sure. So what's that question? I think I answered it, right?
Yeah, you did. So, okay, you want a bizarre question, like a couple of bizarre ones? Let's move to cricket for a bit, because, okay, this is interesting. I wanted to bring it up last week. So we did kind of talk about it, I think, in the first COVID episode. So Kid Twist asks, as a cricket or sports fan, what do you see as the future of cricket and other team sports?
Again, I think they'll largely be played in empty stadiums. Of course, this will take away, I believe, a lot of the drama of any kind of competitive sport. Because no matter how you put it, I mean, if just the psychological act of playing in front of an empty stadium, this will take a lot out of, you know, people who play competitive sports aren't robotic automations, right? When people say we're drawing from the energy of the crowd, this is not a cliche that they're saying. That actually is true. And that will be totally absent in competitive sport. The people who are going to see it are going to feel it. But more importantly, the people who are going to play it are going to feel it. It is not the same playing cricket or any other competitive sport or in empty stadiums where there is absolutely no feedback. As an author, and the reason why people nowadays, even authors, want to more move towards social media is because of the instant engagement. They want to see the RTs, they want to see the likes, they want to see the trolls, they want to see the reaction. When you're writing a book, it takes 5 years for you to write a book, and only then do you realize, then do you get the reaction. The reaction is so important, and in things like sports, which is not the same as writing a book, it's the reaction itself which drives the next move. When you're chasing 250 on a tough pitch, you know, it's the reaction of the crowd that makes you play in a certain way. This is, again, one of the reasons why India used to lose so many times in Sharjah, because the crowd was not behind this team, and this team just didn't have it. And Pakistan, it was behind that team. So, you know, these things matter. And my main worry is, of course, competitive sport is, the money is too much for it not to be there till a vaccine comes out. And as scientists are nowadays saying that even with the vaccine out, it doesn't mean that people will not have COVID. It will just be that it will perhaps be a non-fatal COVID with a vaccine. It's exactly what happens with the flu vaccine, where it's not that people with flu vaccines don't even die. There are people with flu who take a flu vaccine and still die. But in general, if you have a flu vaccine, then the intensity of your flu is less if you get it. So that's pretty much what COVID is going to become, just another strain of a flu-like, and it's not going to go away. So ultimately, the world will make peace with it. I think it already is making peace with it in a certain respect. But my main concern is how the experience of sport will change if it is played in front of empty stadiums, and whether it will change not just our viewing pleasure. It's nice to see a crowd dancing and everything. We in the living room also imbibe some of the energy, but whether it will kind of leave the players a little cold, and that the intensity of some of the things will kind of die out. Because I remember I read somebody saying, you know, that's one of the problems of playing in Ranji Trophy, because there's nobody watching. It's just that you feel as if nobody, you know who that cricketer was a long time ago, was particularly articulate about this. He said one of the problems with Ranji trophies is there's no crowd. There are like five or six people watching, you know, test players who play for the country bat there. And if they're not even there, then there's nobody. And so just to motivate yourself to play for days on end in front of nobody, that itself is one of the biggest challenges.
So in this case, at least they will know that there are millions watching behind the cameras, but it's still not the same thing. I mean, I've lectured in an empty hall to record videos that will then be streamed to students. And it's very different experience than, you know, actually making eye contact with students and seeing, okay, am I going too fast? Am I going too slow? Am I doing a good job teaching? If there's just virtually nobody there who's providing you at least that feedback with their gestures and with their body language.
And yeah, you did discuss this. I think even Joyda had provided more specifics in episode 81 when you raised this point with him. I think he said that the IPL, for example, he said would be more of a caravan setup where there would be three or four cities. So yeah, you can listen to episode 81 where we had Joydas. Just top of my head, Arunab, though, I mean, I was just thinking as you were saying, this kind of reminds me of how actors, you know, these days act with green screens. And they don't really know what it is that's going to be on the other end when they see it on screen. So
yes,
this is kind of like playing with green screen.
Yes, it's playing with green screen, but at least, you know, it's a little different because, you know, the sport is like that. It's not that Virat Kohli is batting and there is nobody bowling and somebody is bowled before. And it's not like that. It's just that it's a difference between doing theater and doing movies, right? You know, people who are seasoned actors, they prefer doing theater because they feed off the energy of the audience. They can get that instant feedback if something is working, something is not working, the ad lib, they go off script sometimes. You know, with a movie, you just don't have that. And that's why people say that, you know, movie actors are weaker for that because, you know, stage actors are the real thing because there's no second take. You do whatever and then if you screw up, then you have to make it up instantly. I don't know. I mean, it would be interesting to see if the intensity of the sport watching experience goes down because of playing in front of empty crowds.
Okay. I'm going to read out the bizarre question I was alluding to earlier as is. And this comes from Abhimanyu Singh Rana. And the question is, what kind of a fetish name is Knight Riders? You guys ride knights, WTF. And
so that's when originally they came up with the name. That's what I said. You know, this is a really strange, bizarre, weird name for a franchise. You know, who rides knights at night? But I've kind of moved beyond that. I mean, at this point of time, the other bizarre decisions taken by the franchise have far buried small things like its name.
Let me ask you this. In terms of just purely names, do you like any of the IPL franchisee names? There is too much of Kings, though. I mean, that is There's my personal crib. Too much of royalty.
There's too much of... I mean, again, it's this... I mean, no team is better than Borishal Burners from the Bangladesh. They've changed the name, unfortunately. But that was like the best name that I've heard of a franchise. I actually like the... I like
what
the
Big Bash names.
Borishal Burners.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I like the Big Bash names actually quite a lot.
I like the original name for Kochi. What Tuskers, it was Kochi Commandos initially.
Kochi Commandos was like, terrible,
are they going to go Commando?
Kochi Commandos was very, 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 very bad. Yeah. Tuskers wasn't much better, but at least it was an improvement over that.
Okay, now a couple of questions. I think you're going to like this one. Soumya wants to know, starts off by saying that till I read The Mine, I never thought horror could be so well written. Do you think writing horror is tougher than other genres, considering it depends a lot on visual storytelling? And also, who are your favorite horror writers, except Stephen King, of course?
So my favorite horror writer other than Stephen King is Shirley Jackson. Haunting of Hill House. Again, the TV series is brilliant, but it's not anything. I mean, it takes the essence of the book, which is a great book. And again, the horror writers, Edgar Allan Poe, of course. Lovecraft, I don't get. I mean, I just don't get it. But Edgar Allan Poe, definitely. Very, very demented. Very demented man. Very, very, very strange stories. And again, it's one of those things that when you read it when you were young, for instance, for The Fall of the House of Usher, when I first read it as a teenager, I felt that, you know, the main guy was, he had done some, you know, he was obsessed with his sister and he had done something and That was what I felt. I thought this was the adult interpretation of Fall of House of Usher. But then when I read it, when I was older, I realized that's not the thing. The thing is that it's not a question of him having an illicit affair with his sister. It's the thing is that the house has taken over his sister. So the house is actually possessing each of them. And the first thing that the guest sees is the house essentially as his sister. And ultimately the house becomes the Usher. So it's the fall of the House of Usher. So it's the house which is actually whatever the evil presence in the house is, which is actually taking over his denizens. That for me is a much more scary thing now. So again, Edgar Allan Poe, I would say, and to those of you who haven't read Edgar Allan Poe, I would strongly recommend that you read Edgar Allan Poe. But in terms of horror, yes, it's definitely difficult to write horror because it's easier to do horror movies because there are all these visual, there's all these, I mean, if you've seen bad horror, like the stuff that comes like Betal and all of this stuff. Now, I tried to sit through one episode of Betal. So why is Betal terrible horror? It is terrible horror because the only thing it can do is it shows blood, it shows insects, it shows parts of people rotting. You know, that is what that is the visual crutches of horror. And nowadays, especially, there is no shock value in these things at all. So they just look like lazy filmmaking and like lazy writing. With books, with writing horror books, you just cannot do that. You cannot use silence, you cannot use music, and you cannot use pure luridity to shock. You have to be very good with writing, but ultimately it has to be the plot. If you read Edgar Allan Poe, if you read the horror masters, it is not that there is a particularly visceral descriptions of horror. It, for instance, in It, there is horror, but it if you see the movie and you read the book, you'll see that the elements of horror are not the same in the book as it is. The movies are much more conventional. You know, Pennywise coming in, the red balloon and everything, they're conventional visual tricks. You've seen them before, you know, the red balloon moving from one place to another, you know, as a symbol that, okay, Pennywise is here. With the book, all these trappings are gone. You cannot use any of this. It just does not translate. And especially in Indian, if you're writing for an Indian audience, where in general if you describe something for 2 pages, you can be virtually sure that nobody is going to read past those 2 pages. People for the Indian commercial market, they want a lot of story condensed. The story density has to be very high. So with horror, that's also problematic because in horror, you know, good horror you have to spend some amount of time establishing the atmosphere. What you can do with one camera shot in a movie would take you perhaps 20 pages of text to do. And many in India, especially in the commercial market that I write in, just don't have the patience to sit through 20 pages for anything. So while they might tolerate that coming from Stephen King, they will not read it if it comes from Arnab Ray. So there is a different, of course, there is a very different standard for the George Martins and these people and for poor people like me who have to make sure that there's a lot of story, that the story itself is horrifying and terrifying in itself for you to keep moving. And that is a challenge of writing horror.
Okay, and we've got, okay, I'm changing gears. Arjun wants to know whether you believe in God.
My view is I'm not an atheist, I'm an agnostic. So I don't deny or accept the existence of God. If God exists, he definitely doesn't exist as a statue, or he definitely doesn't look like anything I've seen in Amar Chitra Katha, of course. But I also understand that there are people imagining gods, and that doesn't make it any the less real. Reality or something existing, if sufficient number of people believe that something exists and that it has meaning for them. Ultimately, again, this is highly philosophical stuff and maybe left for another day, but reality is not just what exists in terms of its existence in the physical world, but it also is what meaning do we ascribe to it. So if you have a statue of Lord Shiva, you know, the communist will say that's a statue. And that's it. It's made of clay, it's painted, So it reduces the statue down to its constituent parts. But for me, it's not, you know, does Lord Shiva exist in that statue? No, I don't believe, my personal belief, I don't believe in God in that respect. But I do believe that there is a sentiment attached to it. I do believe and I do respect, and I do believe that that's what gives it meaning. Meaning doesn't necessarily mean that does that entity exist in the real world or not. In a way, you will never know. But does that have meaning beyond its constituents? Yes, it does. Meaning is what people ascribe to it. And this is not a problem with human beings in ascribing meaning. If we don't ascribe meaning to things, there is really no... we cannot stay alive. For those of you who have read the works of Camus, who was an atheist, kind of, he's basically saying that initially, and this is not an original thought from Camus, but Sartre, Camus, and this is the entire gang of existentialists. So they said that when the Christian religion basically told people that the meaning that you have in your life is God. God provides you with meaning in your life. That attaining God or understanding God is the reason why you were brought onto this earth. Now, with religion on the wane and there being no God, you know, the German philosopher Nietzsche basically said there is a hole inside every human being. That why are we alive? Camus put that in like, what is it that keeps you from killing yourself? That's exactly how he presented the whole thing. You know, if there is no God, if your life has no purpose, then why the fuck are you alive? Go and kill yourself. Why subsist from one day to another? And then he says, well, there is a reason. The reason is the meaning that you ascribe to your life. That meaning is something which you give. So you exist first. It's not what Christians say or what religion says, is that God gave you a purpose and then you were born. No, nobody, God didn't give you a purpose. The politicians didn't give you a purpose. Nothing gave you purpose. You were born, then you choose your purpose. So if your purpose is in that statue, if you choose religion, religion doesn't choose you, you choose religion. But once you choose religion, that doesn't make it any the less real. It's some people choose communism, some people choose Hinduism, some people choose Islam. It doesn't mean that any of them are less real than the other. None of them pre-existed your existence. It's your existence and your giving meaning to that that brings that concept into existence. So for me, religion is like that. Do I believe in God? Okay. Do I believe that if I ask God, God, please, can you make me the CEO of Microsoft tomorrow, that he will make me? No, he won't. God is not listening to my prayers. Nobody is listening to my prayers. So in that respect, no, I don't believe in God. But do I believe that God created the universe, for instance? I don't know. I don't have proof on this side. I don't have proof on that side. Honestly, that's the honest answer. Now, but is there a sense of good? Is there, which maybe there is. Maybe that there is a sense of, and again, this is a choice that I choose. I don't expect you to choose my choice, but just because I've chosen something and you've chosen something else doesn't necessarily make my choice any the less real or any the less legitimate. This is why I believe in, my worldview kind of agrees with existentialism to an extent.
Kind of wish you had a couple of drinks before discussing these, but along the same thoughts.
Not today.
Silent Sloucher wants to know your thoughts on Musk's comment that we may be living in a simulation.
So this is not Musk's comment, but it's not a very original comment. You've right. seen that in Matrix, and this was again a proposition which was. Descartes, the mathematician and philosopher, he comes with, I think, therefore I am. So his main thing was that, radical skepticism, in the sense that what we see around us is, does that actually exist? Or are we a brain which is floating around, in some fluid of a mad scientist who is basically sending sensations to our brain and making us believe that there is a mic in front of me and I'm speaking to it. Maybe it's not a mic, maybe it's a tree. Maybe what I know as a tree is a mic. You know, who said that what I see is what it actually is? Now, what Descartes says is that since we cannot believe anything that we see with our eyes or perceive with our senses, that means that our existence, the fact that I exist, I cannot trust. Except one thing. The fact that I'm thinking whether I exist is the only sign that I exist. Everything else could be simulated. But the fact that I'm having this thought that do I exist are the things, the fact that I'm being skeptical is a sign that is the only proof that I exist as an individual. That is why I think, therefore I am. That's exactly what it means. And it follows from this thought experiment.
Well, that could be part of your programming too.
Yeah, no, it is not. So, that is the great thing. It is not a programming thing because, you see, a computer program which is not alive can also take inputs, right? But it cannot think of itself as, am I taking input? It doesn't have, that is what distinguishes a human being from a robot. And you will find these ideas being used, like Blade Runner, for instance, that entire thing is based on that. So, you know, you have the Blade Runner, the guy is being implanted with false memories. So does the fact that you have these memories, which are essentially a record of having have visual or auditory stimuli, does that make you that person? And at the end of Blade Runner, it's basically saying, honestly, we don't care. Because, you know, the Harrison Ford character ultimately is able, he's the thing that distinguishes, you don't know whether he's a replicant or whether he's not. The only thing that distinguishes him says he's having these thoughts that am I a replicant or am I not? And that itself confirms him, confers on him the humanity. It's not that the question isn't whether he's a replicant or not. The question is he's having that thought and that itself makes him not a replicant in that sense. Or it could be like a replicant, but it doesn't make him a robot. It gives him the humanity. So it's not, humanity is, doesn't necessarily mean it's a feeling that people made of flesh and bones can have in that world. It is anything that allows you to understand or think of yourself as an individual. That's the take that, you know, that science fiction mythos takes. But what I'm saying is that the fact that you are being skeptic itself cannot be simulated because it's not coming from any of your senses. There's nothing in the senses that it could be that, you know, like that scene in The Matrix where the cat goes and then the cat goes again. That is a place where your senses are saying that there is something wrong.
Right.
But other than that, in our normal existence, we never see a cat go to the same place twice. And we think, well, what exactly is this place? Unless you're very, very drunk or high. So unless that happens, then of course, the whole Descartesian experiment fails. But what Descartes says is that in a logically consistent universe where everything is happening the way we think it is supposed to, we don't know whether any of this is being simulated. And even our knowledge of what should happen in the universe, how do we know that it's exactly how things happen in the universe?
All right. And we've got Republic as and Riaf X Peters asking you about the current employment in the current scenario. So the question is, what are your thoughts on changing employment during this period? Is it better to stick to where one already is?
I would say that in this period of time, if you have a job, hold on to it, because the thing is, we don't know. Again, I've always been very optimistic about the economy coming back after COVID-19, but there's always be a gap of one or two quarters. Especially when something like this happens for so long, it doesn't. It's not that, you know, if you turn the economy on like that, everything comes on just like that. It's not things traveling at the speed of electrons. So it will obviously take some time. So if you are trying to, this is a good point of time to actually, I believe, again, there's obviously, you know, don't take this as, you know, 100% advice. It totally depends on. Again, it goes without saying that it depends on what the opportunity is. But in general, this is a point at which point of time, especially if you're thinking about like startups or, you know, the venturing out, you have to think about whether your source of funding is going to last out. Because, you know, when you hear companies saying, you know, so-and-so company got $25 million in funding or $50 million, it's not that somebody comes and writes you a $25 million check right now. Not a check, it gives you $25 in $1 bills. It's a commitment made to fund you. And those commitments can very easily be broken. So, you know, this is that's one of the things that, you know, there are a lot of commitments are going to be broken in the next few months.
All right. I think we've also got some questions which have just come in on Twitter too. First of all, quite a few people asking when we'll have A. Ranganathan on the podcast. So if he's listening, do you have a message for him?
No, I would love to have Anand on the podcast. Actually, he was the person who got me on the News Laundry podcast the first time I ever came on a podcast. I would definitely love to have him on the show.
And some Ranadeep Chandra asks, what would your reaction be if somebody makes a movie or web series based on your novel, but you don't get the direct credit?
And, with Patal Lok is different. There are two parts of it. One is if somebody plagiarizes my work, of course there'll be legal repercussions from me. Even if many times you can't really fight them in court, because what they do is they don't verbatim copy your stuff. They will take the heart of what you did, put it in a different universe and make it sufficiently different, but you know they basically copied the twist or they basically copied the premise. So that is what these people normally do. Now, in case of Patal Lok, because they haven't done it, because they have copied the book in toto, that means this is not a plagiarization. This is not a lift. This is something which has been done with the explicit permission, and perhaps even, I don't know, but this cannot be done unless it's basically licensed. The only reason why they haven't put his name is because of the court case against him and because of the backlash that would otherwise ensue. Because obviously the makers of Patal Lok know that very few people like me, were possibly 50 people like me, possibly read that book when it came out. So there are very few people who will recognize the book and say, "Arey, ye to wo book hai." So, and again, Tarun Tejpal wasn't very famous as a writer. He was more famous for his Tehelka. So, I think that this is definitely this has been done with his permission, because they haven't changed the book at all. This is not plagiarization. They've just not mentioned his name because of the, you know, for obvious reasons. Again, it's highly hypocritical in this case. Either you mention his name and, you know, do it as it is, or not do it. But, you know, doing what they did is, again, you know, hypocrisy to the highest order.
All right. I think that's pretty much it. You've managed to wrap up all the questions
was a question on artificial intelligence and cybersecurity, I remember. I thought to myself, that's a PhD topic in itself. But I don't know if you have that.
Didn't we talk about it last week, though?
Did we? I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think so. I'll give a very brief answer, because I thought of, you know, typing it at that point of time without it becoming a PhD thesis. So the only thing about AI, again, this will not be news for people who are in this field, but for people who aren't, this might be interesting. But right now, security is in a classical security, which is like login, password, two-factor authentication, code signing, all of these are based on a 1-0 view of the world. You either have access to something or you don't have access to something. Even once you're provided, once you provide authentication credentials like a login and password, then you're essentially sandboxed within a system. There are things which you can do and things which you can't do. What happens in AI, and again, this is not new science, this has been there for the last 10 years, is that they provide AI allows you to form behavioral models of what a normal user does and what a normal user doesn't do. So for instance, if I log on to Twitter, there are certain things which I do. There is a certain speed of typing. There are certain actions I take, and there are certain actions which I don't take. Now, if somebody steals my password and logs on to Twitter, then AI technically, you know, if AI is there, it will detect that, hey, this is Arnab Arnab, even though this guy looks like, you know, has the password or has, and at that point of time, what you do is you then, if I don't have two-factor authentication, then it immediately transfers to two-factor and says, okay, let's try to send a, you know, let's send an OTP to his phone and let's see if he picks that up. Otherwise, we lock this account right now. So most of the AI-based techniques is basically called behavioral. You know, malware detection, for instance. Most of the malware things, in antivirus, as we like to call them in the 90s, antivirus was mostly all of them are signature based. So it was essentially what they did was they would look at certain fragments of code within executables, and if those fragments of code had been found in any kind of antivirus, it would be flagged as antivirus. So they would basically take some kind of hash of that and basically analyze code. The problem with that is, if it's new, then you'll never find a match. And also that the database of existing malware keeps increasing, and it's all signature based. That's why you have to keep on, your antivirus has to keep updating itself from time to time with the newest signatures. And now behavior based again says, we'll do all of that, but we'll also look at the behavior of the whatever the code is, you know, how it behaves. For instance, when it's installing, where is it dumping its stuff? And if it's dumping its little fragments in places that normally things are not supposed to go, then you immediately stop it. So this is, again, rather than looking at people's looks, like, you know, it says, let's look at people's behavior. So all of these are based on AI machine learning based approaches, because they have to be done at scale and they have to be done fast enough. Right, you can't wait for 10 days and say that algorithm run and it said, yep, that wasn't Arnav who logged into Twitter, but that wasn't Waqar Yunus who logged onto Twitter. But in this case, Twitter would say, well, Waqar Yunus liking that video, that seems to be like Waqar Yunus, so it's okay, it was him. Anyways, I'm making fun of Waqar Yunus. It could happen to anyone. Let's just put it like that.
And you did have some words of advice for Waqar too.
Yes, that if your password is "I'm a better bowler than Wasim Akram," first of all, it's a very guessable password. Don't use it. Also, it's not true.
Anyway, I think that's the podcast for today. Is that it? Any words of wisdom before we sign off?
No, that's it. You know, everybody stay well, and I'll see you next week.
Yeah, do check out the other podcasts from Forspire, Binge On, and WhatsApp Geeks, and also consider supporting Arnav at his Patreon page. That's patreon.com/greatbong. And that's all for now. And until next time, take care. Bye-bye.